Turn back to 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3, we pick up at verse 8, and we'll read through verse 13. It says, "Now as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds reprobate concerning the faith. But they shall proceed no further, for their folly shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was. But thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience, persecutions, afflictions, which came to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. What persecutions I endured, but out of them all the Lord delivered me. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." So we move on, living godly, as Paul continues the instruction, the theme of believers living in the face of false teachers. He's continuing that theme that we've had from the first of this chapter and bringing it up. He says, "Now as Jannes and Jambres," which he gives us an insight to something that we don't have in the Old Testament, and that is the names of two of the sorcerers, magicians, soothsayers of the Egyptian court that were standing there, withstanding, if you will, which I find interesting, the word that he says, withstood Moses. And yet when we go back and look at the plagues, these men copied the things that were being done. I've never figured that out. I've never understood why these magicians just wanted to copy what Moses was doing instead of stopping what Moses was doing. To me, that would make more sense. You know, you want frogs? Sure, we'll give you frogs. Okay, we'll see if we can make more frogs, or you know, whatever. Let's get more water turned to blood. You don't have enough already, so let's do that too. That's always struck me as kind of strange that they would do such a thing instead of actually trying to stop what Moses was doing, other than the fact that they probably couldn't because God's overruling and is using these plagues for a purpose. But I just find it interesting that they don't go that route. They go the route of duplicating it. But it notes here that they withstood Moses, these men, and we have them named here. So God in his wisdom has decided to give Paul those names that are remained unnamed back in the Old Testament because they're not named in Exodus. So it's one of those instances where God has given some further light, if you will, on an Old Testament passage, much like we see with Stephen in his debate there in the book of Acts. He adds some things that we don't have in the Old Testament narrative as well that God brings to the fore in his day. But we note that here. And so Paul notes these men, and men of corrupt minds reprobate concerning the faith. The word corrupt means just kind of that. They're corrupt. They are depraved. These false teachers, Jannes and Jambres and the false teachers they represent did not corrupt their minds, but were corrupted by others. It's interesting, you know, as you look back at those plagues, and eventually, you know, the magicians in Egypt can't do anything. God limits their abilities to do anything, and they stop. And God continues with the plagues. But they did resist the truth. And it's interesting, we have that with the false teachers of our day and of any day. They resist the truth. They don't want the truth. Why? Because they're false teachers. They have another agenda. And Paul doesn't spare words in reminding us of their character, of what they're doing, that they are without judgment, reprobate, means not standing the test, not approved, or that which does not prove itself such as it ought. The Greek word, which has a negative article to it, means tested or esteemed valuable, as we might test something for its value. It's noting they're not. They don't have that value. They're without that value. And too oftentimes we have a lot of people that want to cater and say, well, they're okay. Now, I understand as Baptists, we do believe in soul liberty. They are, in my understanding of things, you know, they're free to believe the wrong thing. I'm not here to persecute them to the point of trying to beat the truth into their head to change them. Now, I need to speak the truth in love, yes. But in my understanding, they do have the right to believe wrongly. But understand that they face the consequences of that wrong belief. Just as I have the right to believe what I believe to be the truth, because we give that soul liberty. We're not like the Muslims, where it's my way or no way. If you don't believe me, then we're going to enslave you. And, you know, if you don't ultimately believe, we'll just eliminate you. Baptists have not held that particular viewpoint. We are open, I say open, allowing to understand because God's given us that ability. It is up to us to choose the truth or reject it. And we as believers are to give that truth and to proclaim that truth. It doesn't mean that everybody is going to receive it. But he notes this, that these men are of this, and these false teachers are like, but he notes that in all of this, this folly, as he's going to describe it now in verse 9, can be seen if people are willing to seek after the truth and allow the truth to guide them and be the light that it is in the Scriptures. He says, but they shall proceed no further, for their folly shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was, referring back to Jannes and Jambres, and their folly. I mean, their folly came to the point where they couldn't do anything. They came to their end, and their inability to do what God was doing stopped. To the point of not only the Israelites, but the Egyptians to know that God is the Lord. There is only one God. Pharaoh is not God. The things that the Egyptians worshipped at that time, the gods, weren't gods. They were nothing but a figment of their imagination, so to speak. Creatures that they may have, you know, put into gold or carved out of wood. And it's evident. It becomes evident to everyone. The gods of Egypt are powerless before the one true God. And that was for all to see. And you would wish that, you know, the Egyptians would come to the truth of that. I think some did, because we do have a mixed multitude that leaves with the Israelites as they head on their way. But he notes that's there for all to see. And the same holds true in our day and should be, I trust, a help to us, a relief, if you will, that as we deal with people, as we seek to guide people into the truth who aren't in the truth yet, who haven't come to know Christ, or they have been taken in, they are believers, but they're being drawn away by the false teachers, we can trust that the folly of those false teachers will be seen eventually by those that have been taken in so that they can turn away from it. Paul changes directions here. He gives us that three-letter word again in verse 10 and noting kind of this negative stuff of the false teachers, the men shall be lovers, the last days that we find ourselves in and all that's going on. And he says, but thou hast fully known my doctrine. And so the truth resisters are made known. We see Paul's example that he brings to Timothy. And it is helpful for us. And I think Paul is doing well of showing us the negative, but then also touching on the positive, something we learned in college. in dealing with people and in situations was, as it was sometimes called, the sandwich method. Bring up some good things, some helpful things, then hit the point of need, correction, whatever, and then close on the good note again and sandwich that concern, if you will, with these other things. And we see Paul kind of doing that throughout this epistle. He's needing to touch on the hard things, but he's also sandwiching it in with these other good things, if you will. Instead of just being constantly negative, because that does affect us. If we're stuck on the negative and we constantly touch on that, as good and necessary as it may be, we've got to bring in the positive, the good that God has or is doing. I mean, we can look at the world around us. We can see all these things that are going on that he lists in verses 2 and following. And we can get pretty much down. Yeah, that's our world. Man, it's terrible. Well, how about what God is doing? What is he doing in my life today? Yes, that is going out there. And not to negate it, not to gloss over it, but yes, that's there. But that doesn't mean that God's not working. It doesn't mean that he's just set back and he is that grandfatherly person that the DS says that he wound up the clock of this world and now he's just sitting back and letting it go. Not going to be involved in it. You know, no, God is very much involved in the affairs of this world. And he has his purpose and plans that are unfolding. And we can take comfort in that. That yes, this is, but God's got a purpose and plan for this to unfold. This world is heading for a judgment. But he has us, his remnant, if you will, that are to be the salt and light in this world. Because there will be those that are snatched from that worldly lifestyle that will come to Christ. And so he brings in the positive here. He says, but thou hast fully known my doctrine, the teachings, the instructions. And again, this is Paul late in life. He's coming to the end of his life. Timothy has known him for 30-ish years. And so he's known. We've already seen where Paul picks up Timothy in our second missionary journey in the book of Acts on Sunday evening. And so from then until now, he's pretty much been with Paul in some form or fashion. They may come and go, but their interaction has been consistent. He says, you know my teaching, my instruction that I've been giving through these decades. You know my manner of living, the manner of life that I have, or the course of life. It's interesting, this is words only used here, and the word denotes orientation, or hence manner of life. In ordinary parlance, the word came to have special reference to education or its results, that is, breeding or behavior. And that may be well the background that is being used here. You know how I have lived. Why? Because Timothy was with him. He was with him day in and day out on the second missionary journey, as we will see and have seen. I mean, if you're with somebody 24/7, do you know them? You pretty much get to know them. You know their ups and their downs. You know their thoughts pretty much because you're going to be talking with them. So Paul is noting that. You know these things about me. You know my purpose. The placing in view. It's interesting, this Greek word is used in reference to the showbread. And in the Old Testament, in the Greek obviously, since it wasn't there in the Hebrew. But using this word in reference to the showbread that was out on display. But it's the meaning has kind of moved over into the purpose. Why am I here? Why was the showbread there? It was for the priest to partake of. You know my life. You know how I have lived, the purpose for my living. His faith, the conviction of a truth of anything, the word pistis here, long-suffering. His patience, his forbearance, his slowness in avenging wrongs. It is the self-restraint which does not hastily retaliate a wrong. That's that long-suffering that he's referring to here. We've seen that word elsewhere. Love, agape, that godly self-sacrificing love. Patience, again, often a synonym with long-suffering, but not along the in being self-restraining against avenging wrongs, but this is more of the constancy, the endurance. In the New Testament, the characteristic of a man who has not swerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty to faith and piety, even by the greatest trials and sufferings. And so he's patient in what he's consistent, if you will. He's persistent, if you will. Steadfast in doing what God would have him to do. Again, these are things that Timothy saw. I mean, he saw that mindset, if you will, that whole life of Paul. And he's kind of wrapped it up with these words. You've seen me. You know these things. He moves on to the illustrations of patience, if you will, in the midst of the persecutions and afflictions in verse 11. He says, for persecutions and afflictions which came unto me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. So now Paul is taking him all the way back in time. He's kind of going down that corridor of time to his first missionary journey. As he comes into south central Galatia and comes to Pisidian Antioch, to Iconium, to Lystra, where he's stoned and left for dead. The problems that he had on that first missionary journey, which again, some speculate that on that first missionary journey, Paul may have led Timothy to Christ. On the second journey, as he comes back to revisit those churches, he picks up Timothy. He's a believer, he's living for the Lord, and takes him on the journey from there on. But he's noting, you know about these things. You knew what happened to me on that first missionary journey. You saw the persecutions, the afflictions which came to me. But out of them all, the Lord delivered me. What a praise. Again, that word but that he tosses in there. Yes, there were persecutions, and Paul is noting that because they left him for dead. But the Lord delivered me out of them all. God watches over his children. And Paul is bringing those thoughts back to Timothy's mind to help reinforce him, because he is telling him about these things that are happening in the last days, which are not conducive for longevity, if you will, of our life. Because people don't like us. And that hatred seems to be growing even in our day. And so he leads us to verse 12. And notes that there is that prospect of persecution. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. And that can vary. I think I've mentioned it. I mean, it can be a soft persecution, if you will. It can be a hard persecution. Thankfully, in the country that we live in today, we don't have that hard persecution. I mean, we've got the loudspeaker, we've got the sound system going. We haven't bolted the doors. We didn't come in slowly one by one over an hour or two to gather ourselves. We've kept the lights off. We don't sing. We don't turn on our loudspeaker system. And we speak quietly for fear that somebody's going to hear that we've gathered. And when it's time to disperse, we're going to again go quietly a few at a time, so as to not seemingly be detected. You know, we're not living in that. We came here freely, openly, with no concerns. Doesn't mean that that day won't come. But I trust that we will live accordingly. But this persecution may be of other means. I think I've mentioned it back in my spiritual birth hometown, back in North Carolina. down at the Marine Corps Air Station, there was a Naval Air Rework Facility. So, of course, it's military, so they always take that and make it an acronym, NARF. And it's where they would repair planes, work on planes, whether they be Marine airplanes or Navy airplanes. But there were a lot of civilians that worked there. And there were several in our church that would go down the 18 miles to Cherry Point and would work. And they would note there were many a times they were passed over for promotions because they went to Calvary Baptist Church. They weren't part of the in crowd at the facility. They weren't Masons. They weren't other things. They weren't part of that structure. They were outside of it. And even though they may have had the wherewithal, the background, the seniority, whatever, to advance, they often didn't get those. Now, you couldn't exactly pinpoint it and say, yes, it's because, but it's one of those things that you know it's there, but you can't really bring it up and say, yes, it's because they can easily say, well, no, there's other factors involved here. It wasn't because of that. It's these things. And so we can have those things. Is that some persecution? I would say to an extent, yes. A soft persecution. But it's because of who we are as a believer that is affecting these things. So, you know, we will have a varying degrees of this persecution. And so I trust that we may not think, you know, well, nothing's happened to me so far, so what's going on? Am I living godly? Well, live for the Lord as you would. And, you know, our circumstances may find ourselves in different places to have such things happen. And so may we just remind ourselves that we are to be living godly and to realize that if we do suffer persecution, it's for Christ's sake. And to follow what the early church did, they rejoiced that they were counted worthy to suffer for Christ and go forth for Him, living for Him, whatever the cost may be. And so he moves on with that, and we have another but. And I hate to kind of end us tonight on a more negative note, but we do. He says, but evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. As much as we have this going on, he is reminding us these evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving, and they themselves being deceived. It's to me, that is one of the saddest things to witness. Those that believe a lie and believe it's the truth, they're deceived by their own deceptions. And they don't see the truth. They don't see the wrong, if you will, that is going on in this. Think of the abortion issue. How in the world can they not see that that's, you know, a baby? And that you're killing it. I mean, there is no other way to look at that. And yet, there are people that are honest, sincere in their beliefs that it's okay. That somehow isn't a person. You know, they've made that disconnect. And they have deceived themselves to that point of not believing that. And it is truly sad to see these things happen, that this is going on. That they're believing the deception, so they're themselves being deceived by the deception, and they don't get it. Thankfully, we have a God that can bring the light of the truth into their lives, just as He brought the light of the truth of the gospel into our lives. They're not unredeemable. They're not capable of coming to Christ. They are. The truth can get there. And the truth can set them free. But we have that going on. And I believe, I mean, I think we see it in our day. That these evil men and seducers are waxing worse and worse. Deceiving and being deceived. And may we take time to pray and remember them in prayer. God, I know You know this is going on. And You're not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Your message of the gospel is still there. It's still effective. And You can still use it in hearts. And so may we proclaim that truth not only with our voice but with our lives, so that that light can be seen for those that are around us, and God can work in their hearts. We'll hit another but in verse 14 as we take into the next section next Wednesday night as we continue marching through the book of 1 Timothy.